Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Indiana Truth. Back with us is Professor Richard Wolff. For those that don't know Professor Wolff, he's an American Marxian economist known for his work on economic methodology and class analysis. He's a professor emeritus of the of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Welcome back, Professor. Always
Glad to be
a
here.
pleasure. So we just had the NATO summit, or the NATO circus, and you know, I was shocked. Well, two things. I was shocked. One, they wouldn't let the Iranians finish burying Khamenei before starting aggression. And two, I knew the Patriot missiles were made by hand, but my God, 2 years to make a missile, 400 plus suppliers. That's insane.
Well,
How
I
do you?
think.
You know, guys, we talk on the show a lot about wars, power politics, particularly wars of attrition. And as I've said many times, as much more brilliant minds than myself have said over the years, armies travel on their stomachs. But in this case, it's a lot more than food. You have to arm with modern weapon systems your soldiers. So armies travel not only on their stomachs, but also on logistics, supply chains, and even resources, the resources that are in the ground. Now, everybody talks about purified, processed, rare earth minerals that mostly come the magnets that come out of China. But there's other minerals that are mundane. Minerals such as tungsten. Tungsten that is critical for everything. Almost every weapon system that Washington is producing right now, every jet, every tank, every ship, a lot of the submunitions and the main gun rounds, missiles, in some way, all of them contain tungsten. The U.S. hasn't mined tungsten since 2015, 10 years, preferring to buy from abroad. But something that these last conflicts and the Gulf War, what they've shown is that the American supply chain is actually very, very brittle. Washington's understanding this, and they're moving as fast as they can to solve this gaping hole. This is an issue that they're planning on closing. So America needs its own tungsten mine. I mean, 2015 is the last time they mined it. And tungsten has shown itself, especially in these last conflicts that Washington has gotten itself into, it's shown that it plays an oversized role. More critical than most elements, much larger role than most people understand. It's not just a metal, it's national resilience and survival.
The U.S. government is putting billions of dollars on the line. So the question is, can Volt Strategic Mining get the job done? Volt's operating model is straightforward. Acquire historic mines, use modern exploitation tech to maximize value. You know, the first rule of business, as they say, is location, location, location. So tungsten, which is priced near record highs, and Volt is right there in the place that it needs to be. They're not looking for new plays. They're not out exploring new areas that are high risk because maybe there is something there, maybe there isn't something there. They're located in mining-friendly states, such as Nevada, where it's their flagship operation, and they're bringing back, revitalizing tungsten mines that were first put online back in World War II under the Defense Minerals Exploration Act. These are the mines that helped bring the minerals that defended the free world and beyond World War II. These are proven deposits, and they're going to be filling the needs of the U.S. government that are now in existence.
So Interstage Right, Volt Strategic Mining. It's trading under KNOX in Canada. It's KNOX, that's its sign in Canada, and KNXFF, that's a sign in the U.S. They're in the midst of setting up the biggest tungsten strategic project, not just in the U.S., but possibly in all of North America. So what I'm saying here is that this is a de-risked opportunity. You're not looking for a new place. This is a proven area. And tungsten is key, and globally, its prices are skyrocketing. Governments, corporations, they've all realized how much they need it. Not just for military, but also for civilian uses. And they're all scrambling right now to get their hands and lock in reliable sources. So areas like the Great Basin. So this is an area in Nevada. And it's getting some serious attention. This is, by the way, where the flagship operation project of Volt is located, in Nevada. This is North America's historic tungsten belt. The USGS estimated 168,000 tons of tungsten oxide could be located in this area. I mean, and then again, and this is a proven reserve. These are proven reserves that were exploited for quite a long time before one reason or another they were put down and people started importing. And consider today's high prices. That could be an equivalent to that, 168 tons. It could be equivalent to $30 to $50 billion in the ground, and probably higher because prices are going to continue rising. Demand is skyrocketing, and markets are catching on to all of these shortages. Don't get me wrong. There's smart people working there. They're figuring this out. That, oh my God, we need to lock in these sources. The position could appreciate a lot more than it is right now. And a lot of value, and Volt sitting right in the middle of that value.
Now this is where it all gets real interesting. In under 12 months, so less than a year, the U.S. government has taken five major steps to rebuild its mineral supply chains, which are in a horrible condition. This includes the Executive Order 14231 for 14231, Project Volt. There are 55 foreign ministries focused directly on these critical minerals. All this is driven by the fact that the U.S. no longer mines tungsten commercially since 2015. This is why Washington has committed $12 billion for Project Volt and additional federal support, all to establish and secure domestic supply. Washington is in overdrive. Let's not kid ourselves, as they tend to be at when they realize how bad off they are. This has become a national priority. The Pentagon is now actively funding and developing domestic supply chains for the very tungsten that is in the ground at the Volt project. This is an active White House directive. Volt is working hard, systematically assembling what will shape up to be probably the biggest massive U.S. tungsten, and not just U.S., probably North American tungsten profile. Portfolio. If you want to learn more about this, check out my description. There's a link in the description that'll take you to Volt's page where you can learn more about the opportunities that Volt has. And again, a special thanks to Volt Strategic Mining for making today's video possible. And now back to the video.
Maintain that.
I think what we have is We have a spectacle that the way to understand is that basically since the end of World War II, the world was remade to replace the destroyed empires of Britain and France and Germany and Japan and so forth by an informal global empire operated by the United States. The dollar became the world currency. The American military was able to position itself inside the United States as the absolutely crucial mechanism to keep the capitalist economy going. We call that here military Keynesianism. It involves the government stepping in, maintaining effective demand for goods and services by pouring literally endless money into the military-industrial complex. The military were very careful. They located their factories in every county, in every state. One of the reasons you need 400 suppliers is it's very important politically for the military to have a factory in every congressperson's district, in every senator's district, so that local people can add pressure. So one of the things all of our congresspeople agree to, with very few exceptions, is military expenditure. When you see the vote come up, do you support the military budget? Everybody, center left, center right, people in the middle, virtually everybody. Oh, yes, we support that. The quote-unquote agreement on foreign policy isn't that. It's an agreement on domestic policy, which is to put the whole military apparatus in a special containment. That's why even Eisenhower, as far back as early, said, be careful about the military-industrial complex, because he, as both a general and a president, was in a position to see literally what was going on here, and that there would be no way for a different force. So that's why, you know, it's a little bit crazy. You have lots of, but that's not a technical issue. That's a political issue, as these things usually are. The thing I would urge your listeners, though, to think about is that NATO and the leading countries, France, Germany, Italy, Britain, so on, they are at a point in their historical evolution that I think has finally become clear enough in their minds that although they wouldn't say it the way I'm about to, they kind of get it. They understand intuitively what I'm about to say. Feudal Europe was not advanced over many other parts of the world. Feudal Europeans, when they went to China, the few who did, discovered all kinds of culture and civilization there. Mm-hmm. They did in India, they did in many other places. But for a while, starting in the 16th and 17th century, Europe was the place where modern capitalism began, where you had the rearrangement of production from slave and master, ancient time, beyond that, beyond lord and serf, the feudal, into this new arrangement, employer-employee, capitalism. And because the Europeans got to it first, they were able to capture and build on the inherent need of a capitalist system to constantly produce more surplus, if I can use the term, to plow the surplus back into the business to survive competitively, so that the capitalist becomes the growth system par excellence. And after a century or two, they outgrow the available food supply, raw materials, and labor. They pull their agricultural people off the land, into the cities, into the industrial areas. And then, the great breakthrough, they begin to realize that having run out of those supplies in their national territory, they can go abroad using the benefits of their capitalist development to compel other parts of the world to become colonies. The British are the most successful, but the Belgians and the French, Germans, and the Russians, and the Japanese, and even the Americans at the end, learn the lesson. And I want people to think a minute. Belgium, for example, very small country, but the Congo in Africa is an immense country. So you had the immense wealth of the Congo area pouring in to this little country of Belgium, giving them a standard of living, giving them a growth rate, giving them wealth that they could never in a million years have accomplished without their colonies. This process keeps going until the major colonial powers have no more land in the world, not in Asia, not in Africa, not in Latin America, to take. They've done it. They've divided the whole world up. There's a famous conference in Berlin in 1884 where they literally take a map of Africa and draw lines. The Germans get this, and the French get that, and the Belgians get this, and all of that. The culmination of colonialism is World Wars I and II, in which they destroy each other. The worst wars in human history.
Yep.
The number of people dying, by the way, particularly in Russia, but unspeakable. They lose their colonies. They destroy. The only country to emerge from World War I and World War II relatively undamaged was the United States. I mean, Russia, if I understand, lost 23, 24 million people in World War II. Germany yeah. lost 8 or 9. The United States official death count World War II, 400,000.
So, and all military, no, not civilians, or for the most right. part. Yeah.
You know, one bombs fell in Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, and after that, nothing. No damage to the rail system, no damage to the food system, no damage. So the United States emerges dominant. The Europeans, catastrophic. They've lost their colonies and they've destroyed one another. What are they going to do? Well, number one, they cut a deal with the United States. They're terrified because Russia, even though having been terribly damaged, has a pretty strong army intact at the end of the war. The army that moves into Berlin at the end of the war. Even more important, inside European countries, communist parties closely allied with the Soviet Union were powerful. They had come through the Nazi period as leaders of the resistance in places like Italy and France and Greece and so on. And the European capitalist class looked at the Russian army on the border, looked at all their communist parties, and were willing to make any deal with the United States that the United States wanted. And the deal they made was supremacy for the dollar. The U.S. would handle all military protection of the Western Europeans. That was acceptable to America because military Keynesianism was what sustained the economy here. So they would do that. Meanwhile, what could the Europeans do? The Americans financed them to rebuild from the war, 1945 to 1975. When that ran out, what were they going to do? They did two things to keep a desperate capitalism in Europe going. Number one, they began to provide the mass of their people with credit, mostly in the form of credit cards. It didn't exist for the mass of people before the 1970s. And the other thing they did was, failing an empire, they brought the people from Asia and Africa and Latin America to Europe as immigrants. The immigrants were cheap labor, and the credit allowed demand to be sustained. All right. In the latest 10 or 15 years, all of this has been taken away from them. Their own working classes will not permit them to bring more immigrants in. The disruption socially it produces the right wing in Europe, which threatens governments in France, in Germany, and so on. Number two, the Chinese have emerged, destroying their export markets. They cannot compete with the Chinese. They have no chance. And now with Mr. Trump, the American subsidy, the American protection is gone. If they try to develop their armaments, they are 50 years too late. They can't do what the Chinese and the Americans are doing. Just to give you an example, Germany wants to invest $800 billion in a rearmament program over the next several years. But the military budget of the United States for next year alone, one year, is $1.5 trillion. There's no way the Europeans can catch up to that, and they can't catch the Chinese either. No major technical breakthrough that is now fueling the arms race between China and the United States. None of that happened in Europe. None of it is happening in Europe. Europe is falling behind. Okay, it's already number three, far behind one and two, US and China, but it is in desperate shape. And desperate people facing no future, watching the United States, and boy, was that on display in the NATO meeting, pulling away from them, no matter how desperately they pander to the US and Mr. Trump. They know that what Mr. Trump has said and done has not been contradicted by the capitalist class in the United States. They basically are happy with Mr. Trump. He gives them huge tax cuts, and so this is fine with them. And so in the end, they entertain the delusion of the desperate. They have one way out: a war with Russia, drawing the United States in the hope that they can defeat Russia, carve it into four or five countries, north, south, east, and west, and realize a whole new colonial operation for Western Europe. Yep. An expansion beyond what they have already gotten out of unification with Eastern Europe. Everything that we see in Poland or Romania or Bulgaria or the Czech Republic and so forth. This will now be done on a much grander scale, suitable to support Europe for the next half century by carving up Europe. I believe that is what is sustaining the otherwise bizarre demonization of Russia and of Putin. Look at the difficulty, to be honest, that they're having with Ukraine.
Oh, yeah.
They now what? Invade all of Europe? That's crazy. The resistance they would face is horrific. They're not going to do it. They don't need it. The irony is they have the expanse of Russia available to them, most of which they haven't developed anyway, most of the eastern part.
Well, the area that's being fought over is historic Russian land, that central Ukraine that Lenin recreated Ukraine out of. And you're absolutely right. There is absolutely no interest in invading Europe. Russia has 42% of the European continent, the best 42% with the resources and the black earth and everything else. There's no interest in going in and fixing up. You break it, you're responsible for it. Nobody wants the rest of Europe. Nobody wants to pay for rebuilding them. I'm sorry, it's like not just not interesting. But you're right. They do want to cut us up. They keep talking about it.
I think it's what sustains them, because there's a saying in French, faute de mieux. And what it means is, for lack of anything better, they have nothing. There is nothing that Europeans can do at this point. And if you follow European affairs, you can see it at every turn. You know, they can't get cheap Russian oil and gas anymore. They can't compete with the Chinese, even if they did. They can't compete with the United States. The United States has so many problems, it's not going to support Europe. It just isn't going to do it. Von der Leyen agreed with Trump earlier this year to buy, over the next several years, $700 billion worth of liquefied natural gas, and to invest 800 or 700 or 800 billion of European money in the United States. But that's crazy. It's Europe that needs that from the United States, not the other way around. But she had to agree, because if not, he threatened even higher tariffs. And given that Europe is dependent on selling in America, they can't have that. You know, it's just, it is, they are stymied at every turn. I don't know if you're aware, but, you know, could I say it here in America, teach it to people. Earlier this year, there were meetings in Washington between the people who run the Volkswagen Corporation in Germany, discussing with the Trump administration moving the headquarters of Volkswagen to the United States.
Really? Oh, I missed that. Wow.
That fell through. It didn't happen. But then 2 weeks ago, Volkswagen announced the result of not having that deal work out. They're laying off, right now as we speak, 100,000 employees of that company. And the IG Metall, the German union that represents the workers at Volkswagen, is out in the streets confronting them. You cannot do this. We will not permit. That's where Europe is. That's where Europe is. And Germany is the strongest economy there.
Yeah, that's, well, they talk about they want to destroy Russia, rip it apart. But, I mean, realistically, they were getting a lot more than oil and gas from Russia. They were getting, I mean, the very Mercedes-Benz and BMW, they were getting automobile parts that were produced in Russia. They were getting wood products, paper. They were getting, you know, all the different fuels, the refined fuels. They were getting fish. Food, I mean, wheat, chicken. The list is huge. It's your commodities and your semi-finished goods, that sub-assemblies were all coming from Russia, and they cut it all off, plus the energy.
Yeah, no, it's a desperate situation for them, and the rise of the global South, you know, comes with a lot of bitterness left over from all that they suffered for so many years in those countries. They are not in a position, you know. The French held on even after the countries in Africa got independence. They were still economically dependent on France, and now they're breaking away from that.
Mm-hmm.
For example, several of them are making deals with Russia recently in trying to. And between what Russia can do and what the Chinese can do, they have options they never had before. And the Europeans see it. They can't compete. They just, you know, Ivory Coast sends a mission to Washington, then a mission to, I don't know, Berlin, and then a mission to Beijing, and maybe a mission to Moscow. And then they take the best deal. But the best deal is never coming from Europe. It's either the American or the Russian or the Chinese. I hear about it. I see it. I talk to the people who do it. The Chinese offer better terms. It's all, you know, lower interest rate, longer maturity loans, all kinds of hookup deals of various sorts. It just, you can't. You're watching a slow process of decline. And I think if I could turned it a little bit, what you said earlier about the leadership there, and you're right,
mm-hmm.
I see that as in part a consequence, that you're generating leaders that are depressed. They have no way out of this.
Yeah.
They're sitting around, you know, telling each other how horrible Russia is. This is not a very useful activity. You know?
True.
You know, even if you believe it, you know, don't you notice you're spending your time doing it? You're going to give the Ukrainians the capacity to send missiles after oil refineries or whatever it is they're doing inside Russia. You know, the willingness to take chances, to do provocations like that, what goes through their mind? What are you doing? And then to think that because Ukraine can send some missiles and they get through and they do damage, that therefore Ukraine is winning the war. That's hallucination. That's, you know, what are you doing?
I agree.
That's when you begin, you believe in your own propaganda.
That's the worst thing, is they do believe in their own propaganda. Have you noticed what Rubio said was, oh, you know, we do deep strikes too because it's going to bring Russia to the table. And then flip side of that, which they seem to ignore, you've got Peskov, who's the spokesman for Vladimir Vladimirovich, twice has said this is a war. This is no longer a military operation. This is a war. It's true. One hasn't been declared. But then you got Semenyan, who's head of RT, in an interview to Deutsche Welle, just basically said the same thing. It's like, look, you want war, you're going to get war. They're not taking the hint.
No. Because they have no option. There is no option.
What about national forces? I mean, from the people. I'm pretty sure most of the people don't want to go to war. They rarely ever do.
But I don't know, because I'm not in Europe. I don't know how effective the anti-Russia hysteria is. I don't know how much of the European population buys it and so forth. Here in the United States, the war in Iran is remarkable because the majority of Americans state that they don't want it, and they did from the first day. There is. It's really a difficult, very different situation in this country.
But it's, where do you see the U.S. heading? Oh, and the Europeans for that matter, too, because we've got this on and off, on and off, on and off. I guess that's the new norm for the Straits of Hormuz. But what normally you'd have 20 million barrels leaving every single day. Just sort of Straits of Hormuz are now down to maybe 10 million barrels once a week. Where you had 140, you're now down to 10. The U.S. imports a lot of fuel, both as crude and as processed fuel. And Europe is, you know, it's absolutely dependent, has very little of its own. But the markets aren't responding, I don't think. Not to the severity of it, anyways.
Not yet. They're confident that Mr. Trump will find a way out of this situation, even though it looks like at this point he doesn't have one. But you do have to remember that he doesn't, and the people around him are not your normal Western capitalist leadership. These are extreme right-wing businessmen. That's what this is. And they have made a lifetime of believing that American power was always supreme, and anything that looked like a defeat was only because a weak leadership did not make use of the military power that it had. So for them, Mr. Trump has to look like he's mobilizing and using military power. So he has to go back and bomb Iran some more. And so he is going to do that. And my guess, if you're asking that, my guess is he'll do some more bombing. He'll make a big point of how much destruction they have achieved in Iran. That will be half true and half not true. And then he will claim, as he already is, that the Iranians want to make a deal just to get him to stop. And he will make a deal from a position of strength, having bombed them a lot. And he will hope that the American media and the public opinion will look the other way. It didn't work for him with the memorandum of understanding he signed a few days. Hoped it would do that would work. But there he agreed to do things that were crystal clear in his mind he would never do. He always does it. He doesn't believe in, you know, you said that the Putin is a lawyer. Well, Trump is not a lawyer.
No, he doesn't he's not. Know,
does not know or care about any of that. He likes to do things because he's powerful enough to get them done. And so he'll try that. He has to do that because if you know about oil, you'll know there's a difference between what they call sour oil and what they call sweet oil. It has to do with the sulfur in it and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
The United States, while it has an enormous amount of sweet oil, has a refining apparatus that depends on sour oil. And sour oil is what we get from the Middle East.
And
so even the United States. And Venezuela.
Yeah, yeah.
And the United States is not self-sufficient in that at all. So it too will have a problem with rising prices. But if Mr. Trump can achieve the following, either mobilize the country around a war, hasn't done that yet, but he might, or cancel the elections that are now scheduled for the first week of November. If he doesn't have to face a vote, he has a good bit more freedom to have the prices go up and things like that, because there's nothing people can do. He and the people around him do not calculate mass political uprising because they've never seen that here.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that happens elsewhere.
Right.
Example, they were very impressed, very, by what happened in Iran over the last 3 days of the funeral for Khamenei, the Ayatollah that they killed the first day. Watching tens of millions of people in the streets, which we all see here in the United States, for them, that's the wild card. That's the unknown factor that we can't afford to ignore. They know that now, that Iran is weird for them, because Iran was supposed to collapse after 12 days last year.
True.
And Iran was supposed to collapse after 2 months this year. And Iran didn't collapse, not even a little. And this is holding them back. They don't know what to do with that. But they're going to try to see if a collapse may be coming around the corner, if they can just bomb a few more cities and a few more infrastructure. And he has to do that in any case, whether he thinks it'll work or not. He has to do that for the domestic audience. The right wing here wants to see bombing. They do not want to see giving the Iranians reparations or giving the Iranians a relief of sanctions. They don't want any of that. You may be able to get away with it, but then you have to have bombing as the compensation. I wish I didn't have to talk like that, but that is the way the political game is played here. Very, what, very, very dangerous.
What can they and do as a pretext?
One last point.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. If the Americans get the idea that Europe actually could carve up Russia in a war, they will not stand in the way. And my guess is they will help the Europeans. just in the way that the Ukrainians.
They've been trying to do that to us since 1012 AD. And almost every two generations, they come over like lemmings, and then we have to bury them. I don't know why, but
I tell that to my American audiences. I tell them the history of the world is not about Russia invading Europe. It's the other way around.
Yeah, yeah.
It's Napoleon. It's Kaiser Wilhelm. It's Adolf Hitler. That's what.
Charles the Great, and on and on and on. No, quite literally, the first big invasion came in 1012 AD. It was Boleslav Hrabry, the Prince of Krakow, and his Holy Roman Empire allies, and they invaded Kiev, where Saint Vladimir Krasnosolce, who Christianized Russia, was sitting. I mean, they grabbed it, but they couldn't hold it. That's the usual thing. They got too far in. It was still a big country even then. Yes. And they got pushed out. But after that, it's just been on. It's like every couple generations, let's go east. Go east, young man. But what would... Okay, so I don't think Trump's going to get the crowds for backing a war. From what I've read, this war is more unpopular in Vietnam. And Vietnam got to be that unpopular. It didn't just begin like that. This one from day one. But what could he use as a...
What will hold him back here is the fact that Europeans, they can't see it, but they ought to. Somewhere between half and two-thirds of the American people are in serious economic distress. Yes, they have a higher standard of living than many people around the world. That's true, they do. But it is under attack. It hasn't been rising now for quite some time. And there are serious threats on the horizon. And they are very worried about that. And what you will see is if Trump continues this war, is a growing chorus of politicians who will say, vote for us, the money being spent on war, we will instead spend on you. We will help.
Should be that
you.
Way.
Yeah. And, you know, there's going to be, I would guess, a groundswell of support for them. You might even see a spreading of what is already phenomenal. You know, here in New York, as I assume you know, he just elected a Muslim socialist to be the mayor, and he is incredibly popular. I am talking to you from New York City. All my neighbors voted for him, and they will vote for him again. They like him. He is talking only about what he is going to do for the people of New York. He's not giving an excuse not to do it. He's doing it. That could be doing more, yes, but he's doing it. And people are very grateful. And, you know, three more of them were elected this last primary. The Democratic Party controls here. So if you win the primary in the Democratic Party, you're ipso facto in. So three more socialists won. Another one in Colorado, a woman, just the other day. So this is becoming serious. It's becoming serious because these are socialists who are basically what in Europe would be called social democrats. Mm-hmm. These are not communists. These are not anarchists. These are not even class conscious socialists. They are socialists in the European sense. They are people who are going to improve social welfare, who are going to create and fund a welfare state and all of that. But that's radical in this country, and that is now catching on. And that I had not, just so you know, living here all my life, I had not expected to live long enough to see it. And so I'm very impressed that I'm seeing it.
Well, what could Trump do for a pretense to cancel elections? I mean, he's lost the majority of his base, as it is. I mean, granted, the people who are left, quote, in MAGA are cult fanatics, but the majority of people that voted for Trump, he's backed out of every single promise he made to them, taking care of internal issues, ending the wars, quite the opposite. What could he do as a pretense?
Well, I'm afraid that the most likely is what is called here a false flag event,
mm-hmm.
in which, I'll give you an example. When he stands up to speak and somebody shoots a gun and the bullet touches his ear and he has blood nicely on his face and he raises his fist, that would give him a lot of support for a short while. It wouldn't last very long, for a short while.
Hmm.
You have to have something like that. The Mexican government, the private army that Trump created, called ICE, I-C-E, here, mm-hmm. has moved into Mexico without the permission.
How?
And has been killing Mexicans on the grounds that they are drug traffickers. Well, under pressure from Mexican public opinion, the woman who runs Mexico, the leader of Mexico, has said that this has to stop. I don't know what's going to happen now. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And he can't really stop. He doesn't get that. So he's going to realize that he's more powerful than Mrs. Sheinbaum in Mexico. And he's going to push that. I don't know what's going to happen. Canada is moving steadily toward deals with Europe, with Russia. Well, I don't know about Russia, but China and Europe. And I think they're open to deals with Russia. So he's losing them. You know, they don't have much in the way of alliances anymore. And they're not reliable in that way. And the allies know that. And they're making deals somewhere else. Look, Mr. Carney in Canada is anti-labor, pro-capitalist, a profiteer. There's nothing attractive about him whatsoever, except he positions himself as the anti-Trump, and he wins the elections in Canada. Canada's economy is in very bad shape also. And he's not, you know, he's trying to change labor laws to give the profiteer more freedom to make money. The unions are turning against him. He can't keep playing the anti-Trump card forever, although Trump helps him in that regard by making stupid comments all the time.
True, very true.
I don't mean to depress you or your audience, but I don't want to be dishonest. I find the confluence of problems for Europe and the United States very frightening. And I think deluding yourself is a symptom of the difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
It's very attractive to believe that the tables have been turned. Ukraine is going to win. That's very comforting. Or Russia is falling apart. The people are turning against Mr. Putin, or the economy is in trouble. Whatever. Saying this, saying it over and over again, having very little in the way of refutation when people argue against you, these are the signs of people that are in trouble, in a lot of trouble.
Well,
I hope that the leadership in Russia understands this. I understand that they have their own difficult decisions to make, but I am frankly very, very worried. I see the build-up to World War I happening under new conditions, yes, but happening again.
Very true, very true. Well, you know, the The drumbeat out of Europe is every day war, war, war. We're going to carve Russia up. We're going to chop it up. Everybody here hears that. You know, that news, that's just everyday background noise that you hear from the Europeans. And then you get people like Stubb, who really, I do think he's genetically deficient. He looks like it anyways. He comes out with, after saying all of this, after his nationalists come out with these new maps of the future Finnish empire, you know, all 6 million people are going to build this giant empire. Some of them are looking to, we're going to grab Kamchatka. Like, okay, I'm surprised you could spell it. But I don't know where it's at. Yeah, but and then he comes out of, oh yeah, when this is all over, we'll just go back to business as usual with Russia. Like, no, gentlemen, it's not going to happen. And they, I think they're really under extreme delusions.
How, you know, before we close, tell me, because my audiences would be interested. Mm-hmm. How do you assess, where are the, I understand how difficult this question is, but where are the Russian people? How do they process what's going on?
Well, until 2022, most Russian people would have had sympathy for the Russians in the Donbass. For most Russian people, that was something over there. You know, it was beyond the cordon. It was something, you know, I sent aid to people because I've got family all over there. You know, I've seen when the fighting first started in 2014, me and a friend of mine, we took his van, filled it up with clothing, collected a bunch of money, and drove down to Rostov to a church warehouse to bring food and clothing. Because what was happening was the Ukrainians, Ukrainian army, would just start shooting at the Russian villages in eastern Ukraine in the middle of the night. People were grabbing their kids and you know, running out in the middle of the night in their night clothes and running into the woods and the swamps, going east. And then 2-3 days later, they show up in Rostov, you know, disheveled, hungry, crying kids. They couldn't go to the official crossing points because the Ukrainians would shell the crossing point on the Ukrainian side. They tried shelling the Russian side, but they got a lot of response and artillery fire back. So they decided that was not a good idea. So they just shoot at the civilians on the Ukrainian side. Well, you know, we brought, and I watched these people. The church was picking them up, feeding them, clothing them, and then sending them to the emergency services. People are putting them into camps and then letting them, helping them find apartments and places to live in the rest of Russia while things are being settled out in the eastern territories. So, you know, you got to see that. I did, and some other people did, and I know some people that went and fought. But for the most part, it was over there. After that, you know, it took a while for people to start catching on that, oh, this is existential. But I think the majority of people are looking at it as this is existential to Russia's survival. And that what amazed me, you know, there were some of the Azov guys that were taken prisoner in Mariupol. They started testifying. They were told, you know, they were told by Zelensky's government. And Zelensky, by the way, he may still be a Russian citizen, so he may be committing treason because he had a Russian citizenship. He's got Israeli citizitship. He's got St. Kitts. He's got British citizenship. I mean, these guys, you know, it's which passport do I pull out this time? They got an order to murder Russian POWs, mutilate them, take videos or pictures because it'll break Russian morale. Like, well, you know, if you lived amongst Russians, you'd know that has the exact opposite effect. It pisses people off. And every time they commit these kinds of acts, the number of volunteers just explodes, the number of volunteers signing up. So it has the exact opposite effect. Russians, you know, my sensei once described Russians very correctly. You know, if you go into a basement and it's full of stray cats and they're snapping at each other, they're all doing their own thing, it's not organized. That's Russia while it's at peace. But you kick one of those cats, and every single cat in that basement is now coming to kill you. And that's the point of Russia, too. It's like, you just leave us alone. We're on our own. We're doing our own thing. Just, you know, whatever.
But how old is your son?
Oh, no, that was my sensei for when I was taking Shotokan. And the guy, that guy is, he's, I guess he's about 56, 57. My boy's much younger. He's still in school, but so yeah. So but that's Russian culture. You know, Russians adapt. I mean, just to understand. You remember when the Muslim Brotherhood took over in Egypt, and they had a little bit of a civil war there before the military came back and finally kicked them out. Sharjah Sheikh, all these Egyptian. All these Egyptian resorts, everybody ran away. The Russian tourists stayed. They're like, "Yeah, they're not shooting at us." This is the Russian mentality. It's like, you know, it's hard to scare people. Like, yeah, just drones flying overhead. They get pissed off, obviously, when the drones target homes, and they do kill people, absolutely, every day. But that just, I mean, a perfect example is Gorlovka or Yasinovata, where I have an aunt and uncle. You know, they've been artillery attacked. Well, Gorlovka is a prime example. You know, I've been to Gorlovka. I've been down the road of death where they've artilleryed the road and they're used drones to kill civilians and cars. You know, me and two other guys were idiots in this big white van. I went and covered a strike on a market. Thank God the market was just opening up because there was just one guy killed who's still laying behind me as I was videotaping it, and his wife lost her legs. He was the cookie salesman, the pastry salesman. Thankful there weren't any customers there yet. But that's an everyday thing. And Gorlovka's population before the war, and keep in mind, there is no water in Gorlovka because the Ukrainians early on blew up the main water mains. They blow up the pumps every time they get replaced. They blow them up again. Gorlovka's population in 2012, 2013 was 380,000 people. Gorlovka's population right now is 320,000 people. They won't leave. It's like, this is our land. And go to hell, we're not going anywhere. That's the Russian mentality. So when they think they're going to, when you hear Marco Rubio say, oh, you know, deep strikes are going to bring them to the, no, that's actually having the exact opposite effect. The majority of people want deep strikes into Europe. If it was the will of the people at this point, we'd already be in a full conventional fighting war. And the Europeans don't understand that, or they're refusing to understand that, or they're incapable of understanding that.
I think they're counting on Putin's, look, it's the same way the United States counts on Xi Jinping in China, they're playing the long game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't want a I look at Putin, he doesn't want any of this.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
He allowed NATO to cross many red lines when it expanded to the east.
Mm-hmm.
It was only, you know, this is finally, he said, no, not Ukraine. Right? Poland, okay. Czech, okay. But not Ukraine. So.
Well, Russia asked, you know, from the Russian side, people don't understand because they, you know, the stereotypes of Russians are these aggressive psychopaths that just want to conquer everybody. Well, you know who proposed the League of Nations and was first pushing the League of Nations? It was Nicholas II.
Yeah.
He wanted a new European security structure to avoid World War One, you know, and anything like that, any wars in Europe. Russia's been pushing this for 140 years. And unfortunately, we had World War One, we had World War Two because Russia has been ignored. Stalin asked to join NATO in 1948 when he found out it was being formed. Yeah, he didn't quite get it at that point that it was being formed against him. That realization came a little bit later because he wanted a new European security structure. Gorbachev asked to join NATO. I'm not Gorbachev, I'm sorry, Yeltsin in 92. Putin asked to join NATO in 2000. And we are where we're at, unfortunately, but we are where we're at.
Yeah, no, it's a terrible, terrible, terrible situation. I'm very, very worried.
Yeah.
Okay, sir. I have to go. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting talking to you. I hope that I have not been a depressive.
Oh, no.
guest for you.
Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. Well, you got to tell the people the truth. You know, people are adults. They have to face the truth.
What are we spending our time for here?
Oh, absolutely. And the media, you know, you can always switch on television to hear lies and feel good. You know, but that doesn't solve your daily issues. You got to face up to the truth of it.
Can I ask you to send me a link when you're done with this? Because then we'll post it and we'll promote it too.
Absolutely. I will absolutely send the link. I'll post this in about 2 or 3 days. I'll get it up.
Yeah, just whenever it's ready, just send it, then we'll put it up.
Okay, absolutely.
Very good,
Thank you.
Scott.
Thank you
Yeah.
again. Yep. Cheers.
You too.
Hello, dear friends. Just want to remind you, if you like this video or you like what you hear, click like, subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet. Send it to your friends. Let's grow this channel. Maybe we can finally hit it up to 100,000. That'd be a good round number for the summer. So let me know, leave some comments, and give a thumbs up. So look forward to seeing you in the next video. Cheers.